a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
You are listening to Haunt in the Studio, a podcast about horror, the ways it crosses media, and the borderland where fiction and reality melt. Join us as we, your hosts Tyler and Andy, plunge into nightmares both real and imagined, to understand how the different presentations of horror work in different ways, and perhaps gain some insight into why we scare ourselves. In this episode, we're journeying way back into the distant past of horror cinema to have a look at a little-remembered footnote in the catalogue of classic Universal monster movies. And that's two films in particular, House of Frankenstein and House of Dracula, and to some extent their predecessor, Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. Today, we're completely inundated with films that cross franchises, are made up of franchises, or make little nods here and there to the works of a certain director or a certain company. We're kind of used to looking out inside a film to little nods here and there to other films, or to see where a studio might be trying to hint that some kind of crossover film is in the works. We're in the world where shared cinematic universes are these multi-million and in some cases multi-billion dollar behemoths, releasing film after film, year in, year out, making media to make media, to make media, and in the end, to make money. But looking way back, over 75 years, we find a strange little distant predecessor, an ancestor to these types of films. Something that's largely been forgotten, but is kind of strange, and in some ways familiar, with our eyes so far down the line. So we'll be having a little look at these films. On the one hand, as films in and of themselves, because each and every film, even films that are made, say, like the later Hellraiser films, which are kind of just there to hold on to the rights of something without necessarily being a film in and of itself, are still intended to make some kind of money. At least, you know, cover its own costs. But these are films that were made for entertainment. They were made to revive the fortunes of flagging series. They were made with the idea of taking these things that everyone at the time knew, and even though they might have been getting a little old and hackneyed, there was still the intention that these were to make money, and these were to be good films. So we're looking at them in their own terms, as films in and of themselves. A little bit of a review, if you were, or at least our thoughts on them. And then we'll also be looking at them with the glasses of history, seeing the fingerprints of these three films on movies that would come 50, 60, 70 years down the line. It can absolutely be said that many of the horror versus films, stuff like Freddy vs. Jason or Alien vs. Predator, definitively had these movies in mind. People who worked on those films have said as much. But it's still interesting to see the fingerprints of films that most people haven't heard of, that most people wouldn't care about, on movies that clearly a great many people, and some very wealthy people, care a lot about. So, would you like to start by picking which movie we want to talk about first, Andy?
I think, personally, that should probably give the precursor of Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. It is the first of this little triptych. I guess it could have set up what was to come, but for various reasons, what came afterwards was very different.
It was very different. And Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman is interesting because you don't necessarily, if you watch it, have the idea that this is kind of, oh, we're going to throw all of these monsters together in a pot and stir them together. You do get the feeling that there is an earnest attempt here at merging those two stories together with an eye towards perhaps either capping off the two series or to make the joint franchise moving onward. That's at least the feel you get within the movie itself. And I think, in a large part, that is probably because the screenwriter for The Wolfman would go on to write the short story that House of Frankenstein would be a loose adaptation of. It's the same screenwriter as Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, so there's actual direct writing continuity between at least one of those series and Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. But I think you're right. You know, watching those two House films, I just feel a bit disconnected from them. doesn't necessarily feel like they're sequels to it.
But you can tell that they are, considering the way that the Wolfman and Frankenstein meet their end at the end of that film. They're in exactly the same place as they are in the next film.
I was thinking more on tone than...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in tone, they are kind of wildly different.
Yeah, because I think the thing is, I mean, all three are played off seriously, but Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman seems like a much more serious film than the other two, if that makes sense. At the very least, it's much clearer writing than the latter two, where the latter two are taken seriously, but it's so muddled that you could be forgiven for mistaking it as just a gimmick and sort of intended to be a gimmick.
Yeah, definitely. And what the first one did really well was they made the story of both Frankenstein and the Wolfman in this film fit together incredibly well.
And it helps that it is a direct sequel to both films. It just kind of feels like there's more of a basis to it with which Siodmak had to work with in making this screenplay. The two previous films being the original Wolfman from 1941 and Ghost of Frankenstein, which was the fourth in that series, which I believe was written in 1942. And so there's this direct follow-up that you have where kind of the first half or so, maybe not quite the first half, but definitely the first act of Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman is kind of a direct Wolfman sequel. The entire Frankenstein thing comes up later in the film. There's the entire process of Larry Talbot being inadvertently revived and coming under the care of a doctor, finding his feet and remembering who he is, going through the entire process that he goes through after he becomes a Wolfman in the original. You know, he becomes aware of his curse. He knows that this is kind of uncontrollable. He wants to end it. And easily, you know, the most tragic of the characters from that era, because he spends pretty much every film he's in bemoaning that he just wants to die.
The Wolfman is thinking of ending things.
Yeah, the Wolfman is in his room listening to MCR because his mum doesn't understand him. But that gives this film a much stronger start and much stronger footing. So when it introduces the story of Frankenstein, there's reason for it to happen. It's not just stumbled across, as is the case in both of the House movies, where either they are literally just stumble into each other's storylines, or they're literally found frozen in one.
Yeah.
Or they just walk into the story, present themselves to the plot. It's time for me to be integrated into the plot now, please. Whereas with this film, because it functions so much as a direct sequel to The Wolfman and to the storyline of Ghost of Frankenstein has worked in and worked in after the film has had time to get to its feet, figure out what it's doing and start moving, I think that the two are entwined much better in the 1943 film than in the two latter films. An interesting thing about this is that the original intention for Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, because Lon Chaney Jr., had just come off playing both the Wolfman and Frankenstein's monster, which he played in Ghost of Frankenstein, is that he was intended to play both. And I think there's a certain respect in which that gave more focus to this film being made, because in a meta way, if you take the step out of the story of the film, those two stories had already become interconnected because the monster and the Wolfman were literally the same guy. It's the same dude. I don't know how you felt about how cohesive the story was for Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, because that's what came to me. But
yeah, so when we watched these, we watched that one last.
Mm.
Which I'm really glad that I watched it that way. The story of that first one is much more clearly written. It has a real sense of direction and also give the sense of time passing. So each time it gets close to the Wolfman, transforming under the full moon, it feels very natural. And in the latter ones, it's kind of assumed that the viewer will understand how much time has passed. But the only way that they let us know that is by saying, oh, it's another full moon tonight. But you'd be forgiven for thinking that what was happening was literally the next day.
And it's those basic story punches, the story beats being thought out and just kind of making sure they're there, that makes the integration of the two feel more natural. Because in especially the final of these three films, House of Dracula, which I do think has some of the best performances in it, there is just this throw it all together feel to it, where Dracula just walks into the story and Larry Talbot, which is the name of the Wolfman, just walks into the story, and their storylines will get dropped or picked up whenever it's been a little too long since you've last heard of them. And you're right, that does make it extraordinarily confusing, where there's an urgency to Larry's story because he's desperate to be cured or be killed or have this curse ended before the next full moon rises, which gives this natural through line that the film, any film starring that character, should have, where there is a building urgency after each of these peaks where he transforms into the Wolfman and each time he commits a murder. It's very clear that this is something where he doesn't necessarily really care why it's happening. He doesn't care if it's a curse. He doesn't care if there's some 30s, 40s science mumbo jumbo happening. He cares that this is making him a murderer, and he is a naturally fairly conscientious man. He doesn't care how it stops. He just wants it to stop. And there's this natural fluidity that his story should have, where there is this building urgency towards each full moon, and then after it, there is the crash where he comes back to normal and he has this great regret for having transformed once again and failing to stop that transformation from happening, that will then begin building towards the next full moon. And you're right, in the first film, because all of this attention has been paid to, say, the travel montage where he and this old woman who is from the original Wolfman, who is the one that can give him some clarity about the spiritual nature of this curse.
Her own son having been a werewolf.
Exactly. Where the two of them are traveling, they're going to Frankenstein's castle, and it's shown very clearly. It's a long journey. There's a passage of time happening. And essentially what it means is that this film has a natural flow to it that the latter ones don't.
It's the pacing. Mm. It's really well paced. So there is enough action and there is enough story development in between his transformations that you do get the sense of time passing. In House of Frankenstein, which was the sequel to that one, the pacing, it just doesn't exist.
Yeah.
It starts off with a scientist who is
Dr. Gustav Niemann. And this is Boris Karloff as well. So it's not like this film is without things going for it.
Yeah. So Dr. Niemann is in prison because of his experiments with life and death. The person in the cell next to him, Daniel, which is a very pedestrian name for a mad professor's assistant.
Mm. He's much more sympathetic than, say, Bela Lugosi's Igor in the later Frankenstein films.
Definitely.
He's just kind of a guy who's along for the ride.
Yeah. But Daniel, who's a hunchback because of course, this was a film from the 40s, and for some reason, they just always have hunchback assistants.
Hey, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, that was a recent book. Everyone was still, you know, absolutely crazy about it. Classic Lon Chaney film from the 20s.
Yeah.
You know, still fresh in everyone's mind.
They're in prison, and Niemann's discussing Frankenstein's experiments. A deus ex machina comes along, and
they escape
the prison.
A quite literal act of God happens.
Yeah.
And then they just leave.
Yeah, with nobody following, which it happened to Marquis de Sade. It could happen to anyone. they go and find this person with a traveling sideshow who has the body of Dracula in his coffin with the stake in his heart. And, well, they kill him and take his show. And by removing the stake, they resurrect Dracula. The transition from the skeleton to this tenderness being to just muscle to his final fully formed being is quite interesting to watch. And then you get absolutely the least threatening Dracula.
Of nearly any major portrayal.
Of yeah. probably any.
I have to, like, weigh in here because John Carradine, who played Dracula in House of Frankenstein, he wasn't a fresh face on the scene. He was a fairly big-name actor at the time, especially in the world of the Universal monster franchises. So it's really hard to put this on John Carradine, especially because in the next film, he returns as Dracula, and he gives a great performance in that.
Yeah.
So you can tell that he is working with some pretty slipshod writing.
And probably direction as well. I feel like the difference in the direction between Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman and the other two, that's also wildly different, as well as the story. But when he comes in House of Frankenstein, the film just forgets about Dr. Neiman and Daniel, and it basically just follows Dracula for a little bit, and then he essentially kidnaps a woman, and then they die in a car crash.
Well, it's a carriage crash.
Oh, it's a carriage, but, you know, it's still like...
They have a crash, and then it's like, oh, no, the sun came up. Who could have predicted that?
Oh, yeah. No, that's the point, isn't it?
But it is still, like, crazy. How yeah. possibly could Dracula have predicted that the passage of time would happen?
Yeah.
He'd get caught out.
It was... And then it just goes back to Dr. Neiman's story. There is no real reason for Dracula to have been in the film.
So this all happens probably... It's probably all done and dusted by about halfway through the film, maybe a little bit less than halfway through the film. I don't think Dracula is mentioned again for the entire remainder of the film. There's just kind of no mention of the events between Neiman and Daniel escaping and when they make it to their destination, which is the ruins of Dracula's castle. Of Frankenstein's castle. And they discover the frozen remains of the monster and the wolfman. Once they get there and that happens, the rest of the film is almost like it just starts another film. It almost feels like two separate undercooked half-hour films slapped together, but not quite, because still following the story of Neiman throughout.
Well, even worse than that, for me, I felt like they just pause the Wolfman Frankenstein storyline for this little Dracula interlude, and then go back to the story, because all of the scenes with Dracula happen together.
Yes.
Maybe the plan was that when they filmed it, you know, there would be a back and forth, so that it kind of feels like there are two stories that you're following, rather than you just hard cut to this completely different story and then hard cut back when it's over and done with 15 minutes later.
Mm.
It's not hard to see why it got the reception it did at the time and also had a cult following.
Mm. It's one of those things where pretty much every single Universal film from that era has something of a cult following. So that in and of itself isn't surprising, especially given, you know, it's Dracula, Frankenstein, and the Wolfman. So three of the yeah. most recognizable horror creatures, period. But jumping back to Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, look, looking back, it's a goofy name for a film.
Definitely. And there is no reservations about what you're getting into.
Yeah. So you're not going into it expecting this amazing lost classic. But having those two storylines meet just works much more naturally. There's crossover between both films of actors. There is crossover of the screenwriter Kurt Siodmak having written one of the two previous films for the two franchises being drawn together. And not only that, but because Lon Chaney Jr. had essentially starred in both of those two films, and there was kind of, albeit gimmicky, a motivating idea that underpin this story, even though they dropped it primarily for two reasons. One was sheer time, because that would mean if they had done it with just Lon Chaney Jr., that would double the amount of makeup time. And especially with the Wolfman transformations, that was an incredibly involved process.
Yeah, you can see that it has a slow transition, but you can tell that there were maybe eight stages of this transformation that are all layered over top of each other incredibly impressively.
Mm. And, you know, looking back, you wouldn't imagine makeup as being something that labor-intensive, even if it, you know, not with any disrespect to makeup and costuming and whatnot, but you don't conceive of it as a process that dominates the labor time going into making a film. But with those transformation scenes and also just the basic makeup of the classic monsters from that era, it's such an involved process. So to have the same person doing both would have made it such a long and costly process to do it. The other half is that they're relatively physically demanding roles, and there were genuine concerns for the health of Lon Chaney Jr. trying to play both, because it would have necessitated some extraordinarily long working days over fair periods of time as well. So that was dropped, and that's not what you get in the film. In the film, Bela Lugosi is who we get as Frankenstein's monster, and it still keeps that connection because Lugosi had just come off of playing the Igor character, one of the classic depictions of mad scientist's slightly deranged hunchback assistant, in Son of Frankenstein from 1939 and Ghost of Frankenstein from 42. So Lugosi and Chaney had just come off of working together on a film. So there's this interconnection here that all worked in the favor of making this a cohesive film. And I do think of the three, and you've said as much already, it's the strongest, it's got the best direction, it's got by far the most cohesive storyline, but also kind of the most interesting storyline. And it's the one of those three that demonstrated that at that point in time, it was possible to make these kind of crossover movies and make them work, even given the time limitations that are put in place by these films, all having a runtime of about an hour to a bit less than an hour and a half. Whereas to jump all the way forward to now, versus movies, Freddy vs. Jason or something, will still be the flat hour and a half, maybe a bit more. But this big name, big production, Marvel Cinematic Universe, or, well, Dark Universe, but they kind of only made one of those and dropped it. But this big crossover, you know, media events, these are all films that tend to be upwards of 2 hours. There's just more time to work in these crossovers in those stories. Not to mention that going way back to the 40s, because home video wasn't really a thing yet, or it wasn't a thing yet, films tended to have a bit more backstory built into them for people who simply hadn't had a chance to see, you know, the previous film in theater, because that was the only way you could see it if it happened to be screening at a local theater.
And this was a time when Universal were putting out basically a film a month, and also pretty much every other studio was putting out a film once or twice a month.
Mm.
And you had premieres basically several times a week.
Yeah.
But that was the way that films were consumed back then. So that introduces a whole new world of limitations.
Yeah. So there were things working against doing this kind of, you know, media crossover at the time. But I think this film does show that it was doable. And of the three is the one that most clearly points in the direction of this kind of thing happening again in the future and being a viable type of film to make commercially. Because, you know, as much as some of these films, you know, especially your original Frankenstein and Dracula and The Mummy, are held up as being films with some beautiful artistry going into them, especially by this point, but right from the start, they're commercial, they're to make money. That's, you know, it's what the film industry is. As much as I think both of us would like to have a world in which pure artistry and pure entertainment for its own sake is kind of the motivating factor behind these things, a realistic look is going to tell you that that's the most important thing. And if they're going to try and make these films, it's always going to be with an eye towards, is it commercially viable? Is it critically viable? And I think Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman proves that it was, and it is. And jump a few decades into the future, it would be. Especially with only 10 to 15 years down the line, kaiju crossover films, which were right around the corner. You know, Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman releases 11 years before Godzilla. So you don't have to jump 40 years or 50 years in the future to say, oh, check it out. There's all these versus movies and stuff now. That film way back then, that was kind of onto something. You only have to jump about 20. And you're already getting, you know, Godzilla versus
Mothman.
Yeah, versus Mothman. That's the one I want to see.
Yeah.
I want to see
Godzilla versus Ryan Reynolds.
I want to see 150-foot tall Godzilla versus just regular Mothman.
Yeah.
Regular 6-foot tall dude with wings Mothman. And I mean, we're kind of naturally moving towards talking about those latter two House films in a bit more depth. Do you want to like kind of cap off talking about this film? Because I do want to just say this is another great Lon Chaney performance. I think you should watch this because Lon Chaney Jr., every time he plays the Wolfman, which is a character that I never really had much time for because I was like, yeah, it's a wolf, cool. You know, what about, you know, immortal aristocrats and people made from bits of dead bodies? That's way more interesting. But he just plays the character with so much passion and dripping in tragedy. And he does it in this as well.
Yeah. The one thing that I do want to talk about is just how the direction is so much better in the first one. There are scenes where after the Wolfman has turned up in Cardiff, the doctor and inspector travel back to his hometown and they go to the graveyard where the Talbot family mausoleum is. And as they're walking to the mausoleum, there's this beautiful tracking shot that follows them as they move past graves. There's a little fog on the ground. You see these old, disrepaired, this completely dilapidated cemetery, and the guy who works there that's showing them the place says, like, yeah, no, the only people who come here are the dead. Anybody living doesn't have a reason to come, so they don't. And there is quite an attention to detail in that scene. Then again, later on, there's this great scene where after Talbot has reached out to Frankenstein's daughter, Elsa, and asked about her father's notes to see if there's something that could fix him.
Grandfather's notes. Yeah.
They go to the Festival of the New Wine, which has this absolutely marvelous scene where there's a huge crowd of people and everybody's dancing around and drinking and there's a guy who's singing. Everything's really jovial, and there are so many parts to that one scene. It really feels like that whole city is alive and brimming with excitement. And then you get to, you know, Frankenstein, who was a baroness, and Talbot sitting together, and you just see these two wildly different people. Elsa's sitting there, she's having a marvelous time. She knows how to deal with crowds, and there's Talbot, you know, face like a slapped ass,
visibly wallowing in misery.
Yeah. And then when the singer sings a line about wishing eternal life to them,
Talbot stands up and pushes him away and screams at him, why are you singing to me of eternal life? Why would you want eternal life?
Yeah, I just want to die. Just leave me alone. You're ruining my life. Stay out of my room. These scenes, which required a little bit of coordination, but also show that the director knows what they're doing. In the other two films, all of the shots seem so static. The camera's not drifting through areas in the same way. When you get scenes with crowds in them, it's a crowd of maybe 11 people, and they're all like running in heavy air quotes, but they're just cautiously stepping towards whoever they're running towards. And it's just that little bit of magic that was in the first one is just gone.
There's a little bit of a troubled history to the first of the two. And to re-clarify for those listening in, House of Frankenstein, 1944, House of Dracula, 1945. With House of Frankenstein, what had originally been intended was that it was conceived as a film called The Chamber of Horrors, and it wasn't just going to be Frankenstein meets the Wolfman meets Dracula, which is essentially what you get. and not done anywhere near as well. It had been intended to live up to the quote-unquote Monster Rally name that was towards the end of these placed onto this type of film. You can actually find fairly easily, just by looking for Chamber of Horrors 1943-44, the archive of a New York Times article which initially announced the Chamber of Horrors, what would have been from 1944. And it mentions that Universal is planning this grand jamboree of monsters, including not only those three, but The Invisible Man, The Mummy, and The Mad Ghoul, which Mad Ghoul was a 1943 film, so a fairly fresh addition to the Universal monster roster, as it were.
I like that monster roster.
And this was scrapped and then revised into House of Frankenstein. Now, House of Frankenstein, as it stands, is an adaptation of a short story or a short book called The Devil's Brood by Kurt Siodmak, who had been the screenwriter for Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, and who had also been the screenwriter for the original Wolfman from 1941. So I get the sense from what I can find that there was a bit of troubled production going on in the background here. You have an initial concept that's much grander, that's scrapped and then revised. And it being an adaptation, what I read that as meaning is either being The Devil's Brood was this original concept that had all of them together and then was revised, and so was probably fairly disjointed from the original story that Kurt Siodmak wrote. Screenplay not by Kurt Siodmak, so it's someone else writing the screenplay based on this work. Or if it became an adaptation after the Chamber of Horrors idea was scrapped, then you have this original idea, which is revised, and then also becomes an adaptation of a separate work. There's no way I can look at it where it doesn't feel like, at least in the writing and conceptual process, it was a lot more muddled than Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman had been. And I can't imagine any way in which there's both an original concept that's scrapped and revised, but also it's an adaptation where there isn't some real crossed wires in the writing process. Maybe this is just me trying to give this the benefit of the doubt a lot of the time because I love this genre so much. Unless I really, really just don't like something, like I find it to be just mean-spirited and not really have any kind of point to it. Most of the time, I'm going to try and find what kind of limitations were there that led to this perhaps not being as good as the original vision intended. What things in this could be pulled out of it that are still interesting and worthy of your time, even if maybe it's just not a good film. And sometimes, even if you're an optimist, there are just films that aren't good films. And not necessarily get to the point where they're so bad you're good and you loop all the way around and you're enjoying yourself again. Sometimes it's just a film that doesn't really grab you. But yeah, I bring that up because this film clearly had some kind of troubled creative process. I think even if the direction by Eric C. Kenton, who was kind of known as it seems to be a bit of a mercenary director, by which I kind of mean,
I think it's Earl.
I might be, yeah, Earl C. Kenton. But by which I mean a kind of B-movie-ish director who a studio will just tap on the shoulder, say, we've got this product, we need someone to direct it so you can do it, rather than trying to find, you know, a director who most suits the direction of a particular type of story, you know, rather than putting a bit more thought into it.
Yeah, so to summarize all of that, it's more of a reflection on the production company's attitude towards producing the film rather than saying that the director's a bad director or this is a bad film.
Yeah. You summarized what I, in my typical fashion, bloated.
You're just verbose.
Thank you. None of this is also to, like, sledge Earl C. Kenton. The guy did make some pretty good films. He's the one responsible for, or at least directed, Island of Lost Souls from 1932, which is, you know, one of the classic pre-code sound horror movies. So there just seems to have been a lot of factors coming together with some not great directing, some not great cinematography, some not great acting here and there, and it all combined to make a film that, you know, at the time, it wasn't exactly reviewed well. Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman didn't have the greatest of reviews either. It was kind of lukewarm, but there were some people here and there who really liked it at the time. So it wasn't, you know, an outright critical and commercial failure.
And there are some people who like it now.
Yeah, which is... it's been reappraised over the years. That reappraisal has kind of led to it now being considered to be one of the better films, especially from the 40s, out of the kind of universal monster roster, as it were. And also, the film after this, House of Dracula, I do think is much stronger. Now, it didn't exactly have the exact same staff on it. Earl C. Kenton returned to direct House of Dracula the year after, and that is a much stronger film, in my opinion.
Oh, definitely.
I liked that a lot more.
Yeah, that one had the one scene for me that stuck out as a really good moment in the film was when Dracula comes into the house and Melissa is playing the piano. And, you know, Dracula does his creepy stare thing. And she starts playing this really discordant jazzy part that really compositionally, seamlessly comes from, I believe it's Moonlight Sonata or someone's Nocturnes.
Yeah, something like that.
But that piece, it turns into this really dissonant, jazzy piece, and she's frozen while she's playing it. And her response to it is really felt, how she talks about a world that it evokes, which is Dracula's world of the undead and ever-living.
Mm-mm.
That scene is brilliant.
This film, for the fairly average performance that John Carradine gives in House of Frankenstein, he gives a great performance in House of Dracula. He is just as hypnotic and magnetic as that character deserves. And in a certain sense, I feel that he's a bit more devious in this one than in some of the earlier portrayals. One thing to remember with the Dracula films is that Bela Lugosi played Dracula once. The next film is Dracula's Daughter, which he's not in at all. It's about Dracula's daughter. The film after that, Dracula's daughter isn't in it at all. I forget what her name is, but the woman who plays the countess who is using a pseudonym in Dracula's Daughter does a very, very good job. But what that is to say is that this isn't the same as Lon Chaney Jr.'s Larry Talbot or Boris Karloff as Frankenstein. This is a character that was played by different people all the time in that era. So John Carradine's performance in this one, I think, is just as hypnotic as the character generally deserves. And he's very devious in his relationship to the Frankenstein stand-in in this film, because it's not some descendant of Dr. Frankenstein. I forget quite what his name is, but it's a doctor of a sanatorium in House of Dracula that Dracula initially goes to seeking to have his vampirism cured. I wasn't quite sure whether to interpret it as his initial intention being earnest, and then he went back on his ways, or whether he was, you know, intending to simply use this doctor and his good graces from the start. But either way, it plays so well into this very intelligent character. He's not some kind of thoughtless monster like the Wolfman during the wolf transformation, or how Frankenstein's monster is perceived by everyone around it, kind of misunderstood to be an animalistic monster, even if the portrayal is usually one of a much more sympathetic creature who is misunderstood by everyone around it. So this film is directed by Earl C. Kenton. It's a much better film. It gives much more of a chance for the characters, who are still pretty much the same characters as the film before, even though it takes a little while for you to figure out that it's even meant to be a sequel and not just the same type of film. It is quite a while before there's any actual direct connection to the previous film. But it gives all of these characters much more of a chance to breathe and have life in them. Whereas with House of Frankenstein, you get Larry Talbot. Lon Chaney Jr. gives him a great performance every time, but John Carradine's Dracula is pretty average. Glenn Strang's The Strangers, Frankenstein's Monster is given almost no time.
He really just turns up at the end. To be killed again.
Yeah, which is kind of the same in House of Dracula. In fact, in all three of these films, he doesn't get treated well. Frankenstein's monster doesn't get a good run in these films. He doesn't get very much time on screen, and in two of them just turns up to be immediately killed again.
Yeah.
But overall, this film gives these characters a lot more time to breathe and be real, especially John Carradine's Dracula.
Yeah. Also worth noting in House of Dracula as well, there is another assistant, her name is Nina, assistant to the doctor. It's nice to see some female hunchback representation.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Nina is also played as being a very sympathetic character, the same as Daniel in the film before. Both of them, they're nothing like the classic Igor hunchback who's just as mad as the scientist, as kind of this angry, bitter individual who's almost as much of a monster as the very human monster of Frankenstein and the monster of Frankenstein's creation. And both Daniel, who, if I remember right, is played by J. Carol Nash, I believe his name is, and Nina, who is played by Jane Addams. Very sympathetic portrayals, and I like that. It's not what you expect going into these films, and it's nice to have something like that thrown at you.
They both have reason for being there. For Daniel, it's the promise that Neiman gave to give him a new body. Once the Dracula storyline's over and done with, I'm pretty sure like the next part of Neiman's story is that as they're traveling, they move past a traveling caravan.
Yeah.
And Daniel sees this beautiful woman, her name is Alonka, dancing for tips.
Yeah.
And she does this beautiful dance, and he's just transfixed by her. And then the person who's controlling Alonka comes out and demands to get all of the money, but she refuses, so he starts whipping her with the proper whip. Probably not the prop was a proper whip, but Daniel jumps in and saves the day. He starts off by strangling the guy, subdues him, and then starts whipping him.
You know,
giving him a taste of his own medicine. And Alonka, by this, has already kind of passed out. And, you know, he helps her, which is a move motivated by his attraction.
By romantic passion, also.
Yeah. But still, that's far cry from previous assistants.
Mm.
And also contrasts very strongly with Boris Karloff's character, Dr. Neiman, who's trying to follow in Frankenstein's footsteps, idolizing him.
He is very much an acolyte of Frankenstein's pursuit of science, even at the expense of humanity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So Ilanka starts traveling with them. And something that you pointed out after we watched this film was how well the interpersonal relationships between the cast of characters was developed.
Absolutely. I think when we were watching it, I remarked that as they were traveling, they hadn't yet made it to the castle. And not long after they arrived there in that period, more or less in the second act of the film, there's a strong feeling that this could easily turn into like a road movie.
Yeah.
Like a road trip movie. Yeah. I feel like I'm watching a much more lighthearted version of Easy Rider. Because they're all in this carriage, which, you know, to be fair, is still the carriage that they stole from a man that Dr. Neiman had Daniel kill. So they're not necessarily meant to be good people. But there, at this point, is Dr. Neiman, Daniel, and Ilonka. And one interesting thing is that Ilonka is not interested in Daniel romantically because of his deformity, although one of the funny things is that it's not actually that noticeable.
Yeah.
In the film, it doesn't look that extreme.
Yeah, but she doesn't realize it at first.
Yeah, but she is appreciative, and they have a fairly strong friendship besides this unrequited love, which is not something I really expected, for them to just kind of have this human relationship alongside a story of unrequited love. Usually it would be you would expect it to be very flat, where the unrequited love is the only thing there. But eventually they find the frozen remains of Larry Talbot and the monster. They unfreeze them and revive them. And for a while, there's this, almost to the end of the film, there's this five-piece group where every one of them has a definite reason for staying in the group. And that's interesting because it could so easily have been that one of them just slipped out and there's no reason for them to really stick around, but they're there anyway because the story wants them to be. There has been the care to make sure that circumstances have made it so all five of them have reason for both wanting but also needing to stay.
And beyond that as well, which you observed, is that there's also conflict between everyone.
Yeah.
As you said when we were talking about it, after they find Talbot, Ilonka's interest turns to Talbot. She empathizes with him a lot and doesn't want him to meet his final end, which he so desperately wants, and tries to help him. Daniel becomes jealous of their relationship and so starts to resent Talbot somewhat. Also, Daniel starts resenting the monster because
Neiman is putting more of his attention into his interest in the monster than he is into completing his promise to Daniel, which is also something he's doing with Larry. And so Daniel and Larry both have the same kind of resentment toward Neiman, but instead of joining together to try and make Neiman live up to his promise, which is to give Daniel a different body because he's sick of being in the body he's in, and to find some way to permanently scientifically end Larry's life, because that is essentially his cause in all of these films. But because of this interpersonal relationship with someone who, if you take the romance aside, has built up a very genuine friendship with them, and they have a very human relationship, both because of the circumstances and the time they've spent together, that prevents them from effectively forcing Neiman to put aside his mad scientist desires to perfect what Frankenstein never got the chance to, and becomes part of the thing that brings common ruin to all of them in the end. Well, except for Ilonka, because if I remember right, she escapes.
I believe she does, but I honestly can't remember how. Oh!
The end is a bit of a blur because they finally revive the monster, and then the monster dies, and then there's fire, and it all kind of happens at once.
Yeah, no. So what happens is, before that gets resolved, is Daniel resenting Talbot for captivating Ilonka's interest tries to sabotage their relationship by going to Ilonka and saying, do you know why he wants to die? It's because he's a werewolf. He's a murderer. He's a baddie.
Which I'm not. Yeah, by that point, I think Daniel has committed more than one murder. So
yeah, he
can't really say that much.
I think it's three was his body count, which he also makes a point. Part of his resentment towards Neiman as well is what he's made Daniel become. Mm. Who's someone who obviously has a sense of morality and rationalized doing whatever Neiman said as a means to his end, which is to not be a social outcast due to his back.
Mm. And at least in the latter two murders, although not the first, which is entirely unjustified, Neiman is able to reason with Daniel that the two people that Daniel is sent to murder, or, well, he kidnaps them initially, but they die, are both people who condemned Neiman to die. So they're not, you know, morally upstanding agents being murdered for no reason. These are people who also have death on their hands.
Yeah, it's also implied that these two people testified against Neiman for profit.
Yes.
And that they were given a reward for giving their testimony, which initially you might think, well, how valid is that testimony? But the more you get to know Neiman, the more you kind of realize, yeah, he probably was just as bad.
I do find it quite funny that his backstory is that in his attempts to, do similar experiments as Frankenstein. His big thing is that he put a brain of a human into a dog.
Yeah.
Which, something about that is just kind of very funny.
Yeah.
Like, as opposed to, like, I'm going to find the limits of life and death and create these things that are going to allow medical science to stride forward. It's kind of like, yeah, I was fucking around and I put the brain of a man in a dog just to see if I could do it.
But you know what I did? I fucked up and I cut the brain stem at the wrong place. Yeah. I bet Frankenstein wouldn't have made this mistake. I need to learn his secrets. Although I will say that for the first half of the film, focusing on Neiman, I thought this feels like there was a longer story of Neiman, that he's definitely not a hero of the story. He could have been somewhat of an anti-hero, but he isn't given the anti-hero treatment either. It felt like there could have been a film or a story before this in which Neiman could have been set up as this relatable character that, in his goal to learn the secrets of life and death, could have become corrupted somewhat by power, which is something that Elsa in the first film talks about with the doctor who travels to find Talbot.
Yep.
And figures out, oh, I could solve both the problem of getting rid of the monster so that the town feels safe, and also removing Talbot's affliction by connecting them together.
Mm-hmm.
And then what that could have looked like if he had have gone with that, there might have been Frankenstein, who was also a werewolf, and Talbot,
there's a movie we could have gotten,
yeah, who is now a normal man, also could have swapped their minds so that now Frankenstein's suicidal and Talbot's
barely functioning.
Yeah. Which I kind of like the idea of a depressive monster, Frankenstein monster.
I would have liked if one of these classic era films had more directly adapted the book in making the monster a quite intelligent person. Because in the original Mary Shelley book, the monster is very painstakingly and slowly self-taught. So that by the time, after a period of a couple years, finally meets back up with or finds Frankenstein, he is literate, he is fairly erudite and well-spoken, and he's relatively worldly.
In the original story as well, the monster was, like, Frankenstein abandoned the monster.
Yeah.
Because he was appalled.
Yeah.
Essentially at what he created.
He finished what he was making, and the moment he did it, he was like, I don't know if this is a good idea, yeah, actually.
So he abandons the monster, and then the monster has daddy issues. Which
has god daddy issues.
Yeah, which in the idea of themes that were explored during this gothic era, a lot of it's about the duality of humanity, and also presenting the good parts of humanity against the bad parts. So you get a lot of intelligent people, a lot of them being very relatable, but also doing terrible things.
Mm-hmm.
And it played off that, which none of these films really explores.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the purpose of the films.
But it is also something I think we could bring up if we ever do an episode about the original Universal Frankenstein film.
Going back to this idea of another story, this film could have, in an alternate timeline, could have acted as Neiman being more of the protagonist and finally reaching his own goal of mastering life and death. But this character that they've set up initially to seem like they're the protagonist, it just ends up being corrupted by power.
I suppose some of this could be answered if we were to get a hold of and read The Devil's Brood.
Yeah.
And there might be, you know, one or two listeners who hear us going back to Kurt Siodmak a few times and thinking, I think I know that name. Kurt Siodmak is the guy that wrote the novel Donovan's Brain, which is a somewhat well-known sci-fi novel from the 40s that was adapted in the 50s into a film, but is generally considered to be among the better sci-fi books of the 40s.
Yeah, I never made that connection.
Yeah, so if you've been listening to us talking about Kurt Siodmak for most of an episode now, and it keeps itching at the back of your brain, that's probably why you've heard his name.
And now to get to the end of the story between Ilonka and Talbot is after Daniel tries to sabotage their relationship, Ilanka comes to terms with, okay, no, Daniel was right. This is what Talbot is. We don't see that on screen, but you've only got an hour to work with. A lot of this detail is given rapid fire.
Yeah.
A limitation of the time. After Ilanka comes to terms with it, she goes to Talbot, talks to him about it, and Talbot says, they say that the only way to kill a vampire is for them to be shot by a silver bullet. And then she finishes the next part, which is fired by the hand of someone who loves them enough to understand. And then we get a scene of her taking some silver from her jewelry, fashioning it into a bullet and loading a gun.
Mm.
One of the last parts of the film before Frankenstein and Neiman die in the bog.
In a very weird sudden ending.
Yeah. We do see Talbot's final transformation of the film and Ilanka going up to shoot him but having reservations. Then Talbot attacks. We hear a gunshot off screen and both of them come stumbling out from behind some trees and we see both fall. But the ending is ambiguous.
Yeah. Something that House of Dracula probably does right is kind of ignore all of this initially, because it would have been very hard to try and directly make sense of the previous film. So for the first, I suppose, act of House of Dracula, Dracula and Larry are just around, and both of them have sought out the help of the doctor who oversees the sanatorium that they both go to. Unfortunately, instead of quite a clean break, a little bit later in the film, by circumstance, without going too much into the plot, said doctor, when looking for Larry,
who threw himself into the sea outside of Frankenstein's castle in an attempt to once again kill himself.
Once he's found Larry, the two of them find the remains of Frankenstein clutching a skeleton who they say must be what is left of Neiman, which is very confusing. And I just kind of ignore that bit and just presume that they only found Frankenstein's monster. It's kind of the only way to make sense of it. Coming up to this final of the three films, which we've already talked on and off about a fair amount, and I think we've made quite clear that this film has some much better direction in it and a much more cohesive storyline, though still not as cohesive as Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. One thing that is to be said, I think, for this film, besides just it being a general improvement and it having a lot of the same limitations but doing a lot more to surpass them, I do like, kind of still on the theme of interpersonal relationships, there's a strong juxtaposition in the fate of Dracula and Larry Talbot in this film. Dracula, who seemingly earnestly seeks out this doctor to find a cure for his vampirism at the start of the film. Eventually it becomes clear that he has either had a change of heart and now thinks that he can use his current position in the sanatorium to establish himself and get a footing here. It begins trying to turn both the doctor and one of the doctor's assistants. I think he's trying to turn her. I don't think he's trying to just feed from her. That's the way I saw it.
Yeah, it's a little hard to tell because, as you said, he's a little more mischievous. Dracula always plays a little bit of a mind game.
Yeah.
And tries to lure people in rather than going for a full frontal attack. And, you know, he does this with that piano scene that I sang the praises of earlier, which is a brilliant scene, which that one ends when she's able to muster the courage to reach around her neck and pull out the crucifix.
And she's wearing a necklace off, yes.
Yeah. And he recoils. And that momentarily breaks the concentration so the doctor can come in, and which he didn't understand what was going on. He wasn't there for it. So it was a coincidence that he comes into that scene then. But later on, we do see Dracula, after he separates Militza from the group, remove the crucifix from her neck.
The other sort of part of Dracula's apparent plan is that part of his treatment is he's been receiving blood transfusions from the doctor. And at one point, while he is in the process of receiving this transfusion, he hypnotizes Nina and just kind of has her leave. He gets up from the table and reverses it so that his blood is given to the doctor, and the doctor begins to turn himself into a vampire. And so Dracula, again, in this film, is killed off before the end, but he lives on in the story, in a manner of speaking, and his actions become a fair part of kind of the motivation behind the crisis of the rest of the film. But what I was getting at is that with Dracula, even if his intentions initially are a bit unclear, the end point is that he betrays the trust that this doctor has invested in him, that his intentions are earnest and he really wants to end this curse through some means to be cured of his vampirism. And he attempts to use this hospitality to set himself up somewhere new and perhaps even to start an entire new vampire coven or something along those lines. Essentially, he doesn't really want to cure his vampirism any longer, or never did, and is more like, I think I can make a home here. This place seems pretty chill. But he is destroyed for this. Dracula doesn't make it to the end. Dracula is killed off in this movie, as, you know, he is in most movies. But his plan does not come to fruition. He is stopped and he is destroyed. Larry Talbot, on the other hand, who enters the scene not terribly long after Dracula does, seeking more or less the same thing, he would also like a cure, is clearly entirely earnest. Now, he does unfortunately vanish for a fair chunk of the film, where it focuses mostly on John Carradine's Dracula, which at the very least gives John Carradine a chance to give a very good Dracula performance. But Talbot is earnest and grateful throughout. He would like it to be a faster process, but he is still completely earnest in his desire to end his vampirism, and that remains the same for the entire film. At the end of this film, he is finally able to be free of the curse. He ends House of Dracula cured, not cast into stasis again as he is in the rest of the films, just cured. And that is this nice juxtaposition that runs through the film, where both seek for the same thing, but there's a great deal of difference in how they conduct themselves throughout. And the result of how they conduct themselves throughout the film has a great effect on their fate. One little twist at the end of the film that I really, really like, because Larry is an incredibly tragic figure. You know, in the film, there's some mad science mumbo jumbo to explain his being a wolfman,
which kind of the film implies is right.
Yeah.
That it's like, oh, his brain.
The film strongly implies that neither of these ever had a supernatural. It's just kind of some medical mad science mumbo-jumbo.
So with Talbot, it's that his brain's a little bit too big. That causes a hormonal imbalance that, and also psychosomatic effect is that his hormones start going crazy. It causes abnormal growth of hair and difficulty in moderating his behavior.
Mm.
And the technology that's being developed by the doctor, which is a bone-softening agent taken from a
fungus.
That they are growing underneath the castle as it's a dark and damp area, which is very suitable for growing this mold. It implies that that belief or that diagnosis and mechanism for it working is right, which is interesting.
I think irrespective of the film's explanation for it, the point being that Larry is finally cured. The operation or the treatment is successful. However, the doctor, who has Dracula blood in his system and is slowly himself becoming kind of a fusion vampire and mad scientist character, himself becomes a thing that must be stopped. And Larry, who has just been set free from this affliction that turns him into a killer beyond any personal capacity to control, just as he is free from this, finally, after a number of films, because, you know, Lon Chaney Jr. reprises this role repeatedly. I think this is the fourth film that he played the Wolfman in. In this kind of moment where he's like, I'm cured. I'm free. I'm not going to become a wolf anymore. I can be a regular man again. I'm free from this affliction that makes me do these horrible things. something that circumstance forces him to do as soon as he has this moment is kill a man. Because to protect the people around him, he's forced to kill Dr. Neiman. And there's something in that, this touch of tragedy in capping off Larry Talbot's story, because this is the last time that he would portray the Wolfman, so it's essentially the end of the Wolfman as a character in that classic era. At that very moment, he can't escape his personal tragedy. He finally, after all of this searching and pain, comes to a point where the lycanthropy is cured. He's no longer this beastly killer that resides within him that he can't control. Circumstance makes it that he has to remain a killer. He has to, by his own hands, in full control of his own mind, kill a man because of circumstance. And there is, I don't know if that was intentional, but there is something in that that grabs me so much. It's such a clever thing to include at the end of the film. I don't really think it's intentional because there isn't really any emphasis put on it, but it's such a great way to end the story of Larry Talbot, you know, as portrayed by Lon Chaney Jr. And it's kind of one of those things where, you know, it's a bit of a twist of fate because they probably didn't know that they wouldn't be making any more of those films and that most of those series more or less ended there. I believe the only time that Lon Chaney Jr. reprised the role was in an Abbott and Costello film, which is just a comedy film that happens to have the character in it. There were Abbott and Costello meets a bunch of those monsters in the later 40s and into the 50s, which was the last breath of that type of character as kind of a full comedic thing. And a lot of the classic actors would reprise their role to do those Abbott and Costello movies. But in terms of the actual kind of storyline of the films, they probably didn't know that they weren't going to make another Wolfman. Even at this point, with these films getting pretty poorly reviewed, getting at the most lukewarm reception, and not really doing that well commercially either, even at that point, Lon Chaney Jr. was still getting praise for his role as Larry Talbot. So they probably didn't know or have an intention that this would be the end of Lon Chaney Jr.'s Larry Talbot, even if they probably didn't really have any notion that they were going to make another House movie after the poor reception of now two of them.
Mm.
But just the way that fate made it so the end of this series was such a perfect little twist, such a perfect little way to end this character's story, I just absolutely love it. I don't think it's intentional, but the way that this story should have ended is just the way it ended, just like that. Spiel over. I've had my moment.
There endeth the lesson.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it is brilliant way to end it. And that wasn't a takeaway from the end of that film that I had. I didn't even think of that. But it is a really poignant insight.
I think we should probably wrap up with our kind of retrospective thoughts looking at these films from the eyes of now and what they look like, you know, looking back in the modern era, being this early kind of unintentional predecessor to a kind of filmmaking that's just so common and big right now. I don't know how you feel about it, but I look back at these and I kind of see it as one of those things where they were just trying something at the time. There wasn't really an idea behind it that this was some new kind of film. It's just, you know, they had these properties on hand and they were like, these are all flagging, but people still love these characters, so we'll throw them all together on one film and see what happens. Which so much creative endeavor is like that. You know, there's a bit of throwing shit at the wall to it and seeing what sticks. But I don't know how you feel in that respect.
I definitely agree. I think had they tried to resurrect them yet again, that would have felt really cheap. And it really would have undone the artistic merit of the films, because none of these films is going to stand on its own like a Citizen Kane, but
even the best of horror from that era.
Yeah.
That's a bit of a tall order.
Yeah.
But they're not going to stand on their own in comparison to how each of those franchises started.
Yeah. But each of these films does have great things about it that make them still worth watching today, whether it be the cinematography and directing of the first one, the interpersonal relations of the second one, or the story and thematic elements of the third one, which something that I did appreciate seeing is that, you know, nowadays we think, oh, vampires are made when a vampire bites a person and doesn't kill them. But there was this completely different part of the canon, which is that for someone to become a vampire, it takes two steps. The first is to receive the blood of another vampire, and the second is to drink a human's blood. We see with the doctor in the third one, he receives the blood from the vampire during the transfusion. And afterwards, he goes through this slow metamorphosis that starts with these wild visions, which uses footage from previous Dracula films and vampire films that by day haunt him and then by night become a fixation. And there is a scene where he is about to kill somebody, but they're both thrown from the cart in the village, and he does kill him, but he doesn't get to drink his blood. And that is what upsets the townsfolk to make them go after him.
You can't have a film in any way related to the Frankenstein
without a mob.
Without a mob of angry townsfolk.
Yeah.
It's just as much part of the film as this spectacular mad scientist lair with buzzing electricity and a bunch of devices that they're there to do nefarious things, and you know that, but you don't know what they individually do at all.
Yeah, for all we know, they could be Van de Graaff generators and vibrators.
Frankenstein is doing a little tour and he's like, this machine here is what does the reviving. All of this just looks cool.
Yeah.
That big glowing orb thing right there, it's got all the electricity in the middle. Yeah, that doesn't do anything. Yeah. I just turn it on because it looks cool.
Yeah, yeah. It's just a plasma orb. Look, if you touch it, like, it all goes to your hand. Ooh, spooky. But yeah, these films have, in spite of their shortcomings, artistic merit and are also all enjoyable watches. I think it was a good decision on behalf of Universal to put things to rest for a bit, and the way that they did it.
Universal were aware by that point in time that this was the kind of end of what they could commercially do with these characters. By this point in time, House of Dracula is released in the same year that World War II ends. And you and I and people who know a little bit about culture in kind of like the late 40s and 50s, and especially the horror movies and science fiction movies being made about then, know that there was a sea change in taste. The type of horror movie being made and the type of science fiction movie being made and the type of fantasy being made was about to change drastically as the world in which the people who were viewing these lived was changing drastically. They were just at the cusp of, you know, the age of the Cold War and the fear of total and atomic war. And also, on top of that, this renewed period of modern and up-to-date science run amok. You didn't need to look back anymore to the Gothic period and Enlightenment era radicals doing things with science that shouldn't be done and profaning against God and having this entire kind of religious and spiritual element to it. You had science in the here and now that's a threat to us. And there isn't so much of that kind of, you know, spiritual and religious element to it. There's a very famous line that isn't, because it was removed from most prints of the original Frankenstein, where just as he gives life to the monster, he screams, "It's alive! It's alive!" Which is the bit we know. But his next line is, "In the name of God, now I know what it feels like to be God." And that is a big part of the motivating tissue of the Frankenstein story, is this kind of science pushing against the limits of what had traditionally been the realm of religion. That is something that was interesting to revive and make new in the early 1930s. By the mid-1940s, the world was changing, and you could look to stuff that was happening in the here and now to be afraid of. You didn't need to have something that was a little bit abstract or a little bit old to scare you, because what was happening right now was in the real world was far more frightening than any film could tell you. So the way that the world was about to finish its transition into this new and frightening era of the scientific ability to kill off an entire nation or an entire city all at once was making that slightly older kind of horror that was more folksy. It was more about something from the old world that shouldn't be reaching into the new, or something that was pushing against these old world mores that shouldn't. That was kind of starting to dissolve. So, you know, I think Universal probably didn't have any real intention of continuing them, but I also don't think they really had in their mind that House of Dracula and House of Frankenstein would essentially be it. They weren't really, I think, thinking in that broader term. They were just kind of more directed by, well, here's an idea, we'll throw it at the wall and we'll see if it works to give these franchises and this type of movie a little bit more viability for a few more years. Which is why I say, when I was talking about with how Larry Talbot's story ends, there's not really any focus on it, because I don't think they really had the intention that this was kind of it. And as I understand it, I'm pretty sure House of Dracula finishes off the original Wolfman, Frankenstein, and Dracula Universal run. There are a couple more that kept going after that. I think the last of the Mummy films from its 40s revival period was a few years later. And Creature from the Black Lagoon, which is an early 50s film, is usually considered in that crop, even though it's more a film of the new era.
Definitely another one that came from the 1950s. What have we done to the world around us?
Yeah.
It's like a more human-centric version of Godzilla.
Yeah, it is. Because like Creature from the Black Lagoon is about this kind of lost ancestor of humanity that they find. And in certain respects, that gives it a similar feeling insofar as it's kind of something very old that modern humanity is stumbling across.
Yeah, it also has themes of habitat destruction.
Exactly.
And the rebellion.
But there is definitely also a much newer themes underpinning it.
Yeah.
It is, in that respect, a very good transition film. And from that era, it's also one of my favorite films.
Oh,
I love
so
that
good.
Movie.
Yeah, my granny showed it to me.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah, we went to the library and she was like, oh, I want to get out some old movies that I loved when I was younger for my grandkids. And she chose Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Hell yeah.
It was awesome. I loved it. I watched it maybe like 5 times in the like week that she was there.
You know what? Not only did Dudes Rock, but in this case, Grands Rock too.
Yeah. Oh, no, grannies rock harder than dudes, 100% of the time.
In the context of big media taking all the properties of a specific thing, like Marvel movies or DC movies, taking from all of the comic books and just taking all of it and throwing it all together to build these grand, almost operatic universes, not quite operatic, but kind of space opera-esque universes where there's all of this stuff that's all happening at the same time.
With very conflicting
tones.
Tones and canonicity.
Yes. It is interesting to look all the way back at these earliest teething problems that these films had. Because if you watch Zack Snyder's Batman vs. Superman, I don't know, I don't actually like any of those films. That's just one that popped into my head. Or any Marvel movie. The integration of all of these characters together is par for the course. It's not something you even think about. That's just part of the film. There will be some films where it's done well and some films where it's done poorly, but it's just par for the course at this point. It's not something that's still being worked on. So it's interesting in this period, especially like after the quote-unquote MCU has existed for a while and there's, what, like 30 films or something in it, and most of them have enormous budgets and are huge media events, it's interesting to go back to these, even though it's still in, for its time, the big money media world. You know, this is stuff being made by, I'm pretty sure, the biggest film company of its time, Universal back then.
Mm.
Some of its competitors don't exist anymore and have since been merged into companies that we recognize today. But comparatively much more humble origins, where films were, as you pointed out, pumped out much quicker. These were shorter films. They didn't have the kind of enormous budgets and huge amounts of time and labor being put into them, even though they were often on a point-by-point basis much more labor-intensive things to make. It's very almost refreshing to look back at this era where there were teething problems with how do you take these characters and write them into the same story? How do you make the connective tissue that makes these things work? How do you make it stick? There's a certain way in which I found it, even though I probably am not going to watch these films again, at least not for a long time, I found it very refreshing to look at that in light of the intense polish that's put on these kinds of films today.
Mm. There's also a little bit more freedom that they had. They don't resolve how Dracula goes from dying in House of Frankenstein to coming back in House of Dracula. They weren't being marketed to people who have not only seen these films, they've seen film critics' responses, they've gone over the scripts, they've gone away with their own like theories and written their own fan fiction. You know, the stuff we associate with fandom of shared universes today, if they weren't showing in cinemas, they weren't showing anywhere.
Yeah, you might read about them, but unless it's showing, you're not going to see it.
Yeah, so they had a little bit more, you know, wiggle room with getting from one film to t'other, which going back and watching these now with that, now that we have that luxury, is quite obvious that they have limitations that just do not exist today.
Mm-mm. Limitations which led to some very interesting things happening within the films.
Yeah, exactly. And even with that, these are, you know, three still quite compelling, interesting and largely enjoyable watches.
Mm. Yeah. You don't want to end this kind of thing on a bum note and just say, ah, oh, they're all right. Don't recommend them. They are, in many respects, films that are interesting to watch today. And I think I speak for both of us, and correct me if I'm wrong, when I say that I think you should go out and watch them. I mean, if you've never seen any of this type of film before, definitely go and watch Dracula and the Spanish version of Dracula from 31, and go and watch the 1932 The Mummy, and go and watch Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein. Have a feel for that first. But I mean, if you're someone who's watched a couple of those films and you liked what you saw, there's going to be stuff in here that you like as well. I mean, all of them have, because it was such a small world and you can really tell that from the cast, a lot of crossover in actors and actresses, which did mean that the cream of the crop is kind of present in all of these films. John Carradine's a great actor. Lon Chaney Jr. is a great actor. I think Melissa O'Donnelly is the name of the woman that played the nurse in House of Dracula. Melissa, there we go. Lionel Atwill shows up in these films. Boris Karloff is in these films. Mm. Bela Lugosi is in these films. So all of these faces are in here. So you're never going to get a film that has universally like bad performances or anything like that. That is the case so much so that of the films that characters were being drawn from in the original concept for the Chamber of Horror, the one that was scrapped, that was, so it was originally meant to have The Invisible Man and The Mad Ghoul and The Mummy in it as well. Two of those films, a ton of the actors in those films wound up being in House of Frankenstein anyway, even though it was scrapped. I don't think there's anyone from The Mad Ghoul that is in House of Frankenstein, although really would have been cool to have Taran Bay in House of Frankenstein. I would have loved to have seen that beautiful, beautiful Turkish man.
Mm.
One of the best of those really thin 30s, 40s mustaches you'll ever seen.
I love those.
One of the best you'll ever see.
I love those.
Incredibly handsome man.
Hell yeah.
I don't think there's anyone from The Mad Ghoul that turns up, but there's a ton of people who are in The Invisible Man and The Mummy. I mean, The Mummy, obviously, because Boris Karloff is The Mummy. So there's all this crossover anyway, because it was such a small world. But
it's really like time-shared cinematic universe.
Yeah. Yeah, this isn't like a shared cinematic universe yet. This is a shared cinematic haunted house or a shared cinematic one-bedroom apartment. But there is something here that I think you'll enjoy. If it's something that you're already a little bit familiar with, you've dipped your toes in, this is a bit more like wading down to waist deep. But I think there's something you'll enjoy, or something you'll get out of this. They're definitely not the best films that you'll get from this era, but there's something in them.
They're definitely not the scariest films you get from this era either. But that's the thing with horror, is that it's not just what's scary. Because if it was scary, it would just be jump scares. And they'd probably be pretty boring. But no, these are films in and of themselves. And
a lot of horror from this era had such a strong emphasis on drama.
Yeah.
If you're someone who enjoys dramatic films, I actually think this is a great era of film for you to look into. Because there's so much drama in the monster and horror movies of this era, as well as the noir movies.
Mm.
The crime noir movies had an incredible amount of drama in them.
Oh, yeah.
And there was crossover between the horror and noir, especially in the form of all of those universal adaptions of Sherlock Holmes stories, of which there are a ton from that era. We could probably do an episode just on universal adaptions of Sherlock Holmes stories from that 15-year period alone. There's a lot of them. I didn't realize how many of them there were until I looked into it recently. And another thing is that, you know, maybe watch one of these movies not that long after you watch, I'm pulling a blank, Justice League. There we go. That's a recent DC Universe movie. I haven't watched it. But something like Justice League or whatever the new Avengers movie is. I don't know. They come out yearly, I think. I haven't paid attention to them since before the Marvel Cinematic Universe was a thing. Yeah, I grew out of them.
Yeah, I mean,
I stopped
honestly,
being a teenager.
In my opinion, Tobey Maguire is still Spider-Man, and there is only one Fantastic Four film, and Star Trek ended with Deep Space Nine.
Fax machines are still
the primary mode of communication between office buildings.
Yep. The BlackBerry is the most advanced kind of phone or phone-like thing you can have.
Absolutely. New York skyline hasn't forever been changed.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's nothing to talk about. New York skyline has been unchanged for many years.
Since the 1930s.
Yeah.
Since they built the Chrysler building.
So I think watching these films in the context of watching a DC or Marvel film, fill in the blank yourself, I don't watch them, would be interesting. Watching these films in the context of, you know, having just rewatched Alien vs. Predator would be interesting viewings. Even watching one of these films and then going and watching, you know, one of the crossover kaiju films from the 60s would be interesting.
Yeah, watching the 2003 adaptation of The Mummy.
I like that you specified 2003, so it's the sequel to Brendan Fraser's The Mummy.
Oh, I thought that was the first one.
No, that's Brendan Fraser's The Mummy is from 99.
Oh, wow.
I think 2003 is Scorpion King.
Oh, gross.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah, go out and watch Scorpion King and then
watch
this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Go listen to the Scorpion King soundtrack featuring Puddle of Mud. They're so
bad.
Listen
to the Queen of the Damned soundtrack and then watch this movie.
Yeah, watch The Crow.
That is a good soundtrack, though.
Yeah, but watch it. It's
you
a good
just
movie.
Just watch The Crow.
Yeah, just watch The Crow. Then watch this. Then, like, watch every other movie we actually recommend, not as a bit.
At any rate, the point being, watching any kind of crossover film or versus film or film where there's a shared literary basis in more than one story, and then chuck this film on. Chuck on House of Dracula or House of Frankenstein. These films are only an hour and a quarter-ish, hour 20 minutes long.
It's like an hour and 10.
Yeah, they're not very long films. That's the beautiful thing about getting into films from this era, is that it's not, I've got to set aside an entire afternoon because I want to watch a movie. There's something you can just chuck on over dinner. There's kind of a beauty in films being that short. They make it something that is honestly a more doable hobby than a lot of other hobbies.
You could watch these films in the time it takes to watch the director's cut edition of Avatar once.
Mm. You can watch a single Lord of the Rings film, or you could watch probably most of all three of these. At least two. Definitely two.
Yeah.
You could watch House of Dracula and House of Frankenstein, I'm fairly confident, in the same time as you could watch a non-director's cut Lord of the Rings film.
Oh, definitely.
But yeah, so, you know, give these a rewatch right next to one of these more modern versions of this type of filmmaking. And I think you'll get at least an appreciation for the kind of early trial and error going on in the writing that underpins this type of film. The kind of early grasping at how exactly this is meant to be done. The teething problems of making this kind of film. Puts you in mind of the kind of limitations, but also the kind of invention being done in this era. Even though, you know, mid-40s is a little bit after the pre-code explosion of late silent and early talkie innovations in cinema when it was all moving really rapidly. But Citizen Kane hadn't come out, so obviously there was a ton of innovation still to be done in this era of filmmaking. If, you know, black and white films that are an hour or so long and aren't necessarily scary per se, if that isn't something that's going to put you off, then I think there's something here you could find in these. At the very least, it's an interesting little relic of a time when a lot of things we take for granted in filmmaking hadn't been invented yet, or were only just starting to come into existence. I think that's a good note to end things off. So this is Haunting the Studio. As of recording, I'm not sure where exactly in the social media world you'll be able to find us, but definitely Haunting the Studio on Facebook. Check us out there. Send us a message. If you have thoughts about these films, you watch them, you listen to an album or watch a movie or anything that we talk about, get in touch with us. If you have never heard of an album or a movie that we talk about and you have your own thoughts when you go and check it out, let us know. If you're like, I'd never really considered, you know, these 30s and 40s films, and I checked one out and I loved it, we would love to hear that. That would be awesome.
Yeah, if we got anything wrong, absolutely, like, let us know.
Don't tell us at all.
No. Tell us, like, with as much vitriol as you can muster. Like, the most dyspeptic, horrific comments. Send them to us. We'll report them and you'll get banned.
Address all of the vitriol at Andy. All of the compliments specify in the message that they're for Tyler.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'll hear from us next time. By this point, we're a few episodes in, so we've got the ball rolling and we're coming into our stride. But this is Haunting the Studio, and you'll hear from us again.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more at r1.co.nz or wherever quality content is found.